Chapter 10. Trust? Trust's got nothing to do with it. I just don't want them out of my sight. General Karras, after promising full access to his command bunker to the local PDF commanders on Vortovan. Are you sure about this, Commissar? Custine asked, clearly as troubled by the prospect as I was. She and Brocklaw had joined me in my office at my request, and I'd filled them in on as much of the assignment I'd been handed as Amberley would permit. I sighed deeply. No, I'm not, I admitted. But the Inquisitor was quite insistent. These are the troopers she wants. Well, we'd better give them to her, Brocklaw said. At least they'll be off our hands at last. Castine nodded, clearly cheered by the prospect. That's true, she conceded. Despite my best efforts to arrange their transfer to a penal legion, the Munitorium was proving as slow and obstructive as usual, and didn't seem the least bit inclined to send a ship all the way out here just to pick up a handful of cannon fodder. Normally, that wouldn't have been a problem. I'd simply have found space on the next outbound freighter or something, but Gravelax wasn't exactly the hub of the Segmentum. And even what little shipping there normally was had almost dried up as the political situation deteriorated. Even if the worst-case scenario I'd been shown on the Hololith didn't come to pass, it looked as though we were going to be stuck with the five defaulters until we returned to Imperial space, which was going to be months away at this rate. Which, in turn, had meant they were our responsibility for the foreseeable future. Which wasn't exactly what I'd had in mind when I cheated Pargita out of his firing squad back aboard the Righteous Wrath. And on the plus side, Brocklaw went on cheerfully, at least we won't be losing anyone we'll miss. He stopped suddenly, realised what he'd just said, and floundered in a way I would have found comical under any other circumstances. Not you, Commissar, obviously. I mean, we would miss you, but I'm sure we won't. You'll be back. I certainly intend to be, I said, with more confidence than I felt. I still hadn't been able to think of a plausible reason to wriggle out of the assignment, so I'd bowed to the inevitable and started trying to find ways of ensuring my own survival instead. None of the troopers could be trusted, that much was certain, but Amberley seemed confident enough, so my best bet was to stick close to her and hope she had a plan of some kind. On the other hand, chances were that Aurelius's luckless bodyguards had thought the same thing. Like most hivers, I was comfortable enough in a tunnel complex unless someone was actually shooting at me. So maybe the most prudent thing would be to get conveniently lost at the earliest opportunity and make my way back to the compound after a reasonable interval had passed. Then again, if I did that and Amberley survived, she wouldn't be terribly pleased with me, to say the least. The prospect of hacking off an Inquisitor wasn't one to contemplate lightly. The upshot of all this was that I'd spent a largely sleepless night vacillating about my non-existent choices until sheer exhaustion had tumbled me into old nightmares of fleeing from gleaming metal killers down endless corridors, heaving grey masses of tyrannid chitin roaring in towards me like a tide of death, and a green-eyed seductress trying to suck the soul from my body in the name of the chaos power she worshipped.
These dreams would appear to refer obliquely to some of Kane's earlier experiences. The last one in particular can certainly be matched to a specific incident recorded elsewhere in the archive, although the others are a little more problematic. He had encountered both Necrons and Tyranids on more than one occasion prior to this date.
And probably others too, which I was glad not to recall on waking. Jürgen appeared at my elbow, presaged by his usual miasma, and poured me my habitual bowl of tanner leaf tea. Instead of withdrawing as he normally did, though, he hesitated next to my desk. Was there something else, Jürgen? I asked, anticipating some routine query about paperwork I couldn't be bothered to deal with. If I was going to die today, I wasn't going to waste my final hours filling out forms in triplicate. And if I didn't, which I swore to the Emperor I was going to do my damnedest to achieve, he could sort it out for me while I was gone. That was supposed to be an aide's job, after all. He cleared his throat stickily, and a faint expression of nausea ghosted across Brocklaw's face. "I'd like to go with you, sir," he said at last. I wouldn't trust any of those frackheads further than I could throw a bane blade, if you don't mind me saying so, and I'd feel a lot better if you'd let me watch your back. I was touched, and I don't mind admitting it. We'd been campaigning together for the best part of 13 years by that point, and faced innumerable perils together. But his loyalty never ceased to amaze me. Probably because the nearest I've ever got to the concept myself is looking it up in a dictionary. Thank you, Jürgen, I said. I'd be honoured. A faint flush crept up from behind his shirt collar, which, as usual, was open at the neck and stained with something that probably used to be food. Castine and Brocklaw looked suitably impressed too. I'd best go and get ready then. He sketched a salute, about turned with the closest I'd ever seen him get to precision, and marched out, his shoulders set. Remarkable, Brocklaw said. He has a strong sense of duty, I said, feeling cautiously optimistic about my chances of survival for the first time since Amberley dropped her bombshell. We'd been in some pretty tight spots together over the years, and I knew I could rely on him completely, which is more than I could say for anyone else in the team. He's a brave man, Castine said, seemingly surprised by the idea. Most people tended to avoid him, put off by his appearance and body odour and the vague sense of wrongness he exuded. But I'd been close to him for so long, I'd got used to seeing past that to his well-hidden virtues, though I was the last person you'd normally expect to appreciate them. I suppose he is, I said. Well, there they are, I said. They're all yours. Amberley nodded and walked along the line of troopers, meeting their eyes one by one. They were as sullen a bunch as I remembered, gazing back at us in silence. I'd had them march to one of the storage sheds in our sector of the compound at the double, and was pleased to note that none of them seemed particularly out of breath, so their weeks of confinement hadn't left them as out of condition as I'd feared. But then I don't suppose they'd had much to do except exercise anyway. They'd looked vaguely surprised when I dismissed the guards, except for Sorrel, whose expression never seemed to change whatever happened, and stared at me as I sat casually on a nearby crate. I promised you a chance to redeem yourselves, I said. And that chance has now come. That got their attention. Valade looked vaguely apprehensive, Hollenby baffled as always, and even Sorrel seemed to take slightly more interest than usual. Kelp and Trebek just stared at me, but at least they didn't seem inclined to go for one another again. Perhaps it was my personal charisma, or my unmerited reputation, but it was most likely the las pistol in the holster at my hip, which I'd visibly left unfastened for a quick draw. I gestured to Amberley, who stepped forward from the shadows, the black cloak she'd worn before, rendering her almost invisible until she moved. This is Inquisitor Vale. She has a little job for us. Valade gasped audibly as Amberley raised her hand, and her Electu flashed into visibility. Dressed in black as she was, she fit the popular conception of an Inquisitor far more closely than the sultry lounge singer that I'd first encountered, or the cheerful young woman I'd been getting to know, and I could tell that most of them, at least, were properly intimidated. What kind of a job? Trebek asked. I waited for Amberley to reply, but after a moment I realised she was leaving the briefing to me. Not that I knew much more than the rest of us, of course, but I'd pass on everything I could. The longer they survived, the longer I could hide behind them from whatever was waiting for us in the tunnels below. Recon, I said. Into the Undercity. Resistance is expected. Resistance from who? Trebek asked. I shrugged. That's what we're supposed to find out. I take it we aren't expected to survive, Kelp cut in. Amberley met his eyes, staring him down. That rather depends on you, she said. The Commissar certainly intends to. I suggest you follow his lead. It's not going to make any difference to us anyway, is it? Valade asked, with surprising vehemence. Even if we get through this one alive, we've only got another suicide mission to look forward to. I'd worry about that later if I were you, I said. But Amberley was nodding slowly, as though she was being perfectly reasonable. I certainly wouldn't have mouthed off to an Inquisitor in her boots, but I suppose she felt she had nothing to lose in any case. Good point, Griselda, she said. Velaid and the others looked a little taken aback at the use of her given name. I recognised the technique as a subtle piece of psychological manipulation, quietly enjoying the chance to watch an expert at work. Amberley smiled. Suddenly, the full force of her capricious personality manifesting itself again. All right, you need an incentive. If you make it back in one piece, you have my word you won't be transferred to a penal legion. How's that? A total pain in the fundament, so far as I was concerned. The paperwork alone would be a nightmare, not to mention the morale and disciplinary problems which would undoubtedly ensue from trying to integrate such an insubordinate rabble back into a line company. I wasn't about to undermine my own authority by having it verbally overridden by an inquisitor in front of them, though, so I stayed quiet. Maybe I could get them transferred to another command, or assigned somewhere relatively harmless after she'd gone. The local PDF could certainly use a professional training cadre to bring them up to scratch once this mess was sorted out, and we were hardly likely to be coming back to Gravelax. All of us? Hollenby asked, clearly not quite believing his own ears. Amberley shrugged. Well, she did ask first, but I suppose so. Wouldn't be much of an incentive for the rest of you otherwise, would it? No one answered, so I resumed the briefing. An undetermined number of hostiles are holed up down there. Our job is to find out how many, their disposition, and what they're up to. Do we have a map of the tunnels? Kelp asked. For what it was worth, they seemed to be focusing on the mission at least. I turned to Amberley. Inquisitor? I asked. She shook her head. No, we didn't penetrate very far the first time before we were forced to retreat. We've very little idea of their extent or what's down there. Who's we? Trebek asked. My associates, Amberley replied. Trebek glanced pointedly around the shed. I can only see you. The others were injured. That's why I need you. No mention of the dead ones, I noticed, which was probably just as well. It wouldn't fool the troopers anyway. They knew enough about firefights in confined spaces to realise that not everyone she'd gone down there with would have made it out. So to recap, Kelp said, you want us to go into an unmapped labyrinth, looking for something you think might be down there, but you don't know what, protected by an indeterminate number of heavily armed guards, and the last time you tried, you were the only one who made it out in one piece. That about sums it up, yes, Amberley admitted cheerfully. But you are forgetting one thing. Which is? I asked, already sure I wouldn't like the answer. They know I'm onto them now. She smiled, as though it were a tremendous joke. So this time they'll be expecting us.
Another question.
Sorrel spoke up for the first time, puncturing the sombre silence.
Your generous offer notwithstanding, you've obviously chosen us because we're expendable.
His voice was as flat and colourless as his eyes.
I assume you're not expecting many survivors from this little excursion.
As I said before, that rather depends on you. Amberley nailed him with her eyes. I certainly intend to come back. So does the Commissar. She'd got that right, at least. And your question is...
What's to stop any of us putting a Lazran through your head and disappearing over the horizon the first chance we get?
His wintry gaze swept the other prisoners.
Don't tell me you're not all thinking about it.
Good point. Amberley smiled, the amused expression I'd seen before back on her face. If it disconcerted Sorrel, he gave no sign of the fact, but it certainly worried the others. She jerked a thumb in my direction. There's always the Commissar to get past before you can reach me, of course.
And I'll execute any one of you who even looks like they're thinking of making a run for it, I promised.
I would too, because they'd have to kill me as well if they would have a hope of getting away with it, and that would be a highly undesirable outcome from my point of view. Even if you could take us both, and the amusement was abruptly gone from her voice, and I sincerely doubt that, I've lost count of the number of people I've met who thought they could outrun the Inquisition, but you might as well give it a try if you really want to. Then the undercurrent of mirth was back in her voice. After all, there's a first time for everything. I smiled too, to demonstrate my confidence in her, but none of the others did. Sorrel nodded slowly, like a debater conceding a point.
Fair enough, he said.
No one had anything constructive to add, so after a few more desultory questions about the mission parameters, the answers to which all boiled down to Emperor only knows, in any case, I led them outside to where Jürgen had a Chimera waiting, its engine running, and tried to look confident. I would have preferred my usual scout salamander given the choice, but there wouldn't have been room for the entire team aboard it, and besides, the fully enclosed passenger bay would discourage any last-minute attempts at desertion, or so I hoped. "Your equipment's already aboard," I told them, standing well back until they'd embarked, like an ovine hound shepherding a flock through a gate, although the canines tend not to use las pistols to emphasise the point, of course. 5 bundles of kit were waiting for them, each one wrapped in a carapace vest with a name stenciled on it, and they all picked out their own as they boarded. "Check it carefully," Amberley told them. "If there's anything missing, you won't get a chance to come back for it." "Discharge papers?" Trebek said, raising a tension-relieving laugh from Velade and Hollenby. "Something's wrong here," Kelp said, shrugging into the body armour. "It fits. Quartermaster must be slipping." It was an axiom among the guard that kit only came in 2 sizes, 2 large and 2 small. "I had a word with him," Amberley said. "He assured me that there wouldn't be any complaints."
"I'll just bet he did," Kelp muttered.
"Hellgun, shady!" Velade hefted a new weapon, looking incongruously like a juvie on Emperor's Day morning. As a regular line trooper, she was only used to handling a standard-issue lasgun, the more powerful variant normally being reserved for stormtroopers and other special forces. At least her evident enthusiasm for her new toy seemed to be keeping her apprehension in check. "Nice," Kelp agreed, snapping a power cell home with practiced precision. "We thought the extra punch might come in handy," I said. Amberley had suggested I replace my battered old las pistol with the handgun version of the heavier weapon, but after some hesitation, I demurred. I'd got so used to it over the years that it was more like an extension of my own arm than a weapon, and no amount of added stopping power would compensate for the different weight and feel of a replacement throwing off my instinctive aim. In a firefight, that could mean the difference between life and death. I'd grabbed a set of the body armour, though, and wore it now, concealed beneath my uniform greatcoat. It felt a little heavy and uncomfortable, but a lot less so than taking a lasbolt to the chest. "It just might," Trebek agreed. She was busily hanging frag grenades from her body harness. Most of them had a couple, along with smoke canisters, luminators, spare power packs, and all the other odds and ends troopers carry into the field. The exception was Hollenby, who carried a med pack in place of the grenades, but his expertise in battlefield medicine made him more valuable patching the others up if the necessity arose. And if it came down to grenades in a confined space, we were pretty much fragged in any case, so a couple more or less wouldn't make any difference. "You can take the brute force approach if you like." Sorrel sighted along the length of his long las and made a minute adjustment to the targeter. I'd taken the trouble to find the weapon that used to be assigned to him, knowing that a sniper gets as attached to his weapon as I was to my old pistol, and that he would have customised it in a dozen subtle ways to improve its accuracy.
"I've got all the edge I need right here."
He must have realised the strings I'd had to pull to obtain it for him, because he met my eyes at that point and nodded, a barely perceptible thanks. I was astonished. Up until then, I'd been convinced he had no emotions at all. "Just make sure you keep it pointed in the right direction," I said, with enough of a smile to take most of the sting out of the warning. It was still there, though, and an expression I couldn't quite identify came close to surfacing on his habitually impassive face. "I could use a few more pressure pads," Hollenby said, inventorying the medkit with the speed of long practice. I gestured to the primary aid box bolted to the Chimera's inner bulkhead. "Help yourself," I invited. He burrowed rapidly through it, scavenging several items which made the bag on his belt bulge, and stowed a few more in other pouches and pockets, discarding a couple of ration bars to make room for them. "Better eat that," Velade advised, taking the seat next to him. "You'll only get hungry later if you leave it."
"Yeah, right,"
he agreed, breaking one in half and offering the rest to her. She took it with a smile, their hands touching for a moment as her fingers closed around it, and Amberlee grinned at me. "Aw," she mouthed, her back to them. "How sweet." Maybe to her, I thought, but to me, it was little more than another potential complication in a catastrophe just waiting to happen. I quelled my irritation and picked the remaining bar off the bench. "She's got a point." I split the bar with Amberlee. "Better stock up with carbohydrates while you can. You'll be burning a lot of energy soon enough." "You're the expert," she said, as though anyone else's opinions mattered a damn on this foolhardy expedition. She sniffed at the grey fibrous mass and bit into it cautiously. "You people actually eat this frack?" "Not if we can help it," Villade said. "Then I'm definitely surviving this." Amberlee swallowed the remains of her ration bar with a grimace of distaste. "No way that's going to be my last meal." The troopers all laughed, even Sorrel, and I marvelled again at her powers of manipulation.
Coming from Kane, that's a real compliment.
By playing the civilian outsider, she'd reinforced their sense of identity as soldiers with great subtlety. I doubted whether it would be quite enough to weld them into a cohesive unit, but that wasn't really an issue on this assignment. All that was necessary was that they work well enough together to get Amberlee the intelligence she required, and me out in one piece, of course. They were still far too many weak links for my liking, though. Kelp and Trebek were professional enough to put their rivalries aside for long enough to get the job done, I hoped, especially with an inquisitorial pardon up for grabs, but the way they kept avoiding eye contact with each other was a far from encouraging sign. And whatever was going on between Villade and Hollenby might just be enough for them to put their concern for each other ahead of the mission objective or the survival of anyone else. Like me. And as for Sorrel, well, he flat out gave me the creeps, and I was determined not to let him get anywhere I couldn't keep an eye on him. I'd met psychopaths before, and he had all the hallmarks. He wouldn't hesitate to sacrifice the rest of us to save his own skin. Of that, I was sure.
An old expression about pots and kettles springs to mind at this point, as well as a saying about taking one to know one.
And then there was Amberlee. Charming as I found her, she was still an inquisitor above all else. And that meant that all we were to her was a means to an end. A noble and important one, no doubt. But that would be of little comfort to me when the black bell tolled.
He is speaking figuratively here, the tolling of the Black Bell of Terror being a well-known soldier's euphemism for death in action. I hardly think he would have expected such an accolade in actual fact.
So it was little wonder that my palms were tingling as I closed the tail ramp and activated my combead. "All right, Jürgen," I said. "We're ready to go." This time, there were no waves and cheers as we left the compound, although I had no doubt that the rumour mill had spread the news of our departure just as far as before. I was quietly relieved by that, to be honest, as this was to be no easy victory for our newly forged regiment to take pride in and celebrate. This would be a desperate struggle for survival. I didn't need my itching palms to tell me that. Although how desperate, and against how terrible a foe, I still at that time had no inkling. And that was a mercy, let me tell you. If I'd known then what awaited us in the undercity of Mayo, I would probably have broken down in hysterics from sheer terror. As it was, I masked my concern with the ease of long practice and kept a stern eye on the troopers, hoping any agitation I felt would be mistaken for vigilance. To my relief, they seemed to be settling, focusing more on the mission now that it was underway. And if they weren't exactly on the same wavelength yet, at least they weren't jamming each other. That reminded me I hadn't reported our departure to Castine yet, so I retuned my combead to the command frequency and exchanged a few words with her. As I'd expected, her mood was sombre, and she wished me luck as though she thought I might actually need it. I was beginning to find the tense atmosphere inside the vehicle a little claustrophobic, not to mention being rattled around like a pea in a can by Jürgen's habitual driving style. So I popped the turret hatch and stuck my head out for some fresh air. The sudden rush was invigorating, almost taking my cap with it as I emerged, and I checked the heavy bolter so I'd have an excuse for staying out there as long as I could. It was primed and ready, of course, Jürgen having done his usual thorough job, so I was able to settle back and enjoy the spectacle of the local civilian traffic swerving out of our way. There seemed to be a lot of it, I noticed, particularly in the main boulevards, but there was no obvious pattern to the movement. There was just as much going in each direction, and when I glanced down the crossways, they all seemed choked as well. Inquisitor, I sub-vocalised, switching to the channel Amberley had given me earlier. I hadn't seen any sign of a bead in her ear, but that didn't surprise me. For all I knew, she'd disguised it in some way or was stuffed with augmetics that did the same job, and a great many others, as I was to discover over the course of our association. There seems to be a lot of civilian activity. Anything we should be aware of? There was actually a great deal we should have been aware of. Of course, the conspiracy we tracked was far more extensive and dangerous than we had imagined, but at that point, I was still blissfully ignorant of how much trouble we were in. Probably lots of things, Amberley sounded wary, though not particularly concerned. But we'll just have to make do with what we know and proceed with caution. Easier said than done with Jürgen driving, I thought, but she was the expert. I watched as he swerved us around a slow-moving cargo lifter, its flatbed jammed with civilians carrying hastily assembled bundles of possessions. Probably just spooked by our raid on the heights, but the implications troubled me. I began to look out for similar sights and found several in the space of a handful of seconds. I voxed Amberley again. "It's looking like refugee traffic up here," I said. "Intriguing," she responded, a note of curiosity entering her voice. "What would they be fleeing, I wonder?" "Nothing good," I said, speaking from bitter experience, "although, in truth, it wouldn't be that unexpected for anyone who could to be leaving the city by now. The political and military situation was still balanced on a knife edge, and it wouldn't need someone of Mott's intellect to deduce that things would be a lot healthier somewhere else if it all boiled over. No harm in checking everything, I thought. So I hopped through the tactical frequencies, finding a lot of garbled traffic on the PDF net. Very little of it seemed to be making sense, though. "Commissar," Castine's voice cut in suddenly, "I think you should know we've just had instructions to go to combat readiness." "Who from?" Amberley interrupted before I could respond. I suppose I might have resented her butting in, let alone monitoring my supposedly secure messages, but right then I was too busy swinging the bolt around and taking the safety off. A thick column of smoke was visible ahead of us, rising from a burning truck in the middle of the road, and the traffic was beginning to stall and gridlock as panicked drivers tried to find a way around it or turn back. Bright las bolts were scoring the air, but who was shooting and what they were aiming at remained obscured behind the smoke. "By order of the governor," Castine said. "Imbecile," Amberley said, along with some qualifying adjectives, which I'd last heard in an underhive drinking den when someone turned out to have more than the conventional number of emperors in their tarot deck. I began to suspect that Governor Grice's political future was going to be short and uncomfortable. "We'll have the tau on our asses like flies round a corpse." "I think we already have," I said. Something was moving inside the smoke, fast and agile, twice the height of a man. It wasn't alone, either. There were more of them moving back there, and the whole pack of them was surrounded by little darting dots. I suddenly remembered the flying platters we'd seen at the Tau Enclave, and that they were armed too. Abruptly, unnervingly, the leading dreadnought, the same type El Sarath had called battle suits, swung its head in our direction and turned, a pair of long-barreled weapons mounted on its shoulders coming to bear. We were still a long way away from being an easy target, but I've always been cautious, so I hailed our driver. "Jürgen," I shouted, "get us out of here." By way of reply, he swung us abruptly towards a narrow alleyway, crushing a raised bed of ornamental shrubs beneath our left-hand tread and barging a small, sleek ground car out of the way. The driver's volley of profanity was drowned out by a sudden thunderclap of displaced air as something hit the front of an omnibus right where we'd been a moment before, reducing its entire nose to metallic confetti before raking the length of it, blowing a tangled mass of wreckage, blood and bone out of the back. Before I could see anything more, we were behind the shelter of a building, our hurtling metallic shell gouging lumps out of the walls, our tracks leaving a trail of burst and flattened waste containers in our wake. "Emperor's bowels, I said, stunned by the narrowness of our escape. What was that? Amberlee asked, her voice almost drowned out by the complaints of the troopers around her. I tried to explain the best I could, still shaken by the range and accuracy of the weapon deployed against us. Sounds like a railgun, she said, apparently unperturbed. Nasty things. Could it have damaged us? I asked, making sure the spare ammo boxes were in easy reach. There was nothing ahead of us now except more panicking civilians, but I wasn't planning on being taken by surprise twice, you can be sure. Easily, she replied cheerfully. Even at that range it could have gutted us like a fish. The Emperor protects, Jürgen said piously. Well, he hadn't done a hell of a lot for the bus passengers, I thought, but decided it wouldn't be tactful to say so. He'd only take it as a sign that we were important to his ineffable plan anyway. Who were the Tau engaging? I asked. The PDF, Castine said. Who else? We're getting reports in that some of the loyalists have mutinied and opened fire on the Tau compound. The diplomats are trying to calm things, but the Blueys are claiming they have a right to retaliate and have entered the city. They're engaging every PDF unit they come across. What about the guard? I asked, already sure I wouldn't like the answer. The governor's orders are to contain the situation by any means necessary. The Lord General is asking for clarification. Playing for time, in other words. If the guard units entered the city, they'd be caught in the middle. With half the PDF unreliable, they'd become a target for both sides. My stomach lurched, and for once, it wasn't due to Jürgen's driving. Well, that's it then, I said, the words like ashes in my mouth. We've run out of time. The war that so many people had sacrificed so much to avoid was upon us at last, and it seemed there wasn't a damn thing we could do about it.